Anything combat with Johnny K.
But it's anything combat, though.
Welcome back, Combatants, the Anything Combat Show, where we discuss everything mixed martial arts. I'm your host, Johnny K, and today we're joined by a black belt coach who gives jiu-jitsu tips online, ADCC North American champion. He got the gold medal in 2014, the 88-kilo division. Owner of Gracie South Tampa, is a UFC veteran. Please welcome to the show, Matt Arroyo. How are you?
Good. How's it going, man?
I'm good. So everyone would be annoyed with me if I didn't ask you about your work with Dave Bautista, seeing that I saw you working with him when he had his purple belt. Now he has his brown belt. I want to ask you, how legit is Dave Bautista's jiu-jitsu, and how long have you been working with him?
So I met Dave Bautista in 2013-14. We met outside of a gym in here in Tampa. He lives in Tampa, and we exchanged numbers, and you know, he wanted to do some private training and all that.
And we didn't really link up until years later. And he was a purple belt when I met him. He had been a purple belt for years and years because he had his acting career and his rep career and a lot of stuff stopped him in daily training. And really just the fact that he couldn't get got hurt, he would not be able to do his move, do all that kind of stuff. So eventually we started training. I was trying to help him, you know, get to the next level. And he's amazing, man. He doesn't use much strength. You would think a guy that big and strong would just, you know, you'd be like, oh man, I got to roll with him. It's more smooth and flowy, and he'll use the strength when he needs to, but mostly it's just smooth technique. He's a good passer. He likes the half guard. He likes the Kimuras. Great wrestler. Like every time you try to come up for a sweep or anything, he just sprawls on you. And he's just an awesome guy. Humble. Everywhere you could think of being humble. Normal as can be. You know, he's not one of those Hollywood guys that's a diva. He's just a normal dude and a great friend.
So, coach, let me tell you a story with what happened to me yesterday in practice. So, I get on, I look at my hand on my bicep, and for some reason, I've got this, and now I've got this. So, I've got two Stahl's infections, one on my right bicep and one on my left wrist from yesterday. So, I just got on the antibiotics yesterday. I asked around, seeing that I train at three or four different gyms because of the show here I get invited. So I don't know where I've gotten it. I've asked around everywhere. Everyone's denied that their gym has given this to me. I know I didn't get it from hanging out at home. So what do you think? What do you think's happened to me? And how do you prevent your team from getting stuff like this?
Yeah, unfortunately, if you train jiu-jitsu long enough, you're going to get it. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. The things that I do to stop it is I try to cover every ounce of my body. So if I'm doing no gi, I like to wear long sleeve rash guards. I like to wear a spec always. Knees are and elbows are usually the number one and two places you're going to get it because it's always touching the floor. So I always do that. So in the gi, you know, I wear a rash guard underneath. I try to wear spats underneath because a lot of times your ankles and stuff are exposed. And, you know, cleanliness of the mats does matter. But to be honest, if one person gets it and they train, a lot of people don't know they have it. That's the problem. They think it's a pimple. They think it's, whatever, just something on their arm or their shoulder or elbow. And they train. And then when sweat builds up around it and then drips onto other people, as disgusting as it sounds, it's very, very, very contagious. And the key is just covering your body, showering right after class. Like, don't hang around for an hour and talk to friends and all that. Shower. If you're going to drill after class, that's fine. But get your butt in the shower. Use Defense soap or Dial soap or some kind of antibacterial soap, not just the regular Dove, you know, bar soap. And wash yourself right away and get home and relax. But, and if you have it or you see somebody that has it, point it out to the coach. You know, you don't have to be a rat, but just say, hey, man, listen, that thing on your arm is not a pimple. That's probably staph or folliculitis or something to that extent, which is contagious. You got to get off the mats. And I tell my students, if I see it all the time, I see it and I'm like, dude, you got to go home, So if it's in the beginning stages, you could take a tweezer. This is what I actually just did this to my son last night. My son has something going on. I don't know what it is. It could be any staph, folliculitis, anything. But you take a tweezer, you pull out all the hairs that are around it. If there's a white head, if there's a hair in the white head, pull that out. Take a cotton swab, dip it in alcohol, wipe all around it, and then put a Band-Aid on it. And usually, if you get it in the beginning stages, it goes right away. But if you let the infection go and it keeps, you know, getting bigger and stronger, you're going to need antibiotics, and you got to go see a dermatologist, and they'll take care of you. 5 days, you should be good to go. Ringworm, same kind of thing, except you can go to the CVS or drugstore and get Lotrimin, rub it on, in 3 or 4 days, it'll be gone as well. It sucks.
Why is ringworm different to your cases of staph?
Ringworm is a fungus, and staph is a bacteria. So antifungal creams like Lotrimin or Tufactin, Tenactin, or all that athlete's foot type stuff should get rid of that just fine. Again, you could always just go see a dermatologist. They'll just like the extra strength stuff and get rid of it a lot faster. I know not everybody's number one thing is get back, and that's mine. And some people know they have it and they still train anyway, which is kind of messed up because they are risking spreading it. And then once, you know, a few people get it, it's like a virus. It just spreads and you get, you know, sometimes the whole gym gets it and it's just terrible. I've had that happen a couple times, and you know, so you got to be proactive. You got to get ahead of it, and you got to educate the students on what's going on.
Have you ever seen someone with my case where I've gotten two in a row with different areas?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Some people have it on their head, face, inside their arms, on their knees. Don't scratch it and don't touch around, man. Just like, get the lotions, the little ointments, put it on, take the antibiotics, and try not to touch it. There's times where you should cover it if you're going to be around people or things, and there's times you should leave it open and let it breathe. But yeah, 20 years of training, that's my experience with it. I've probably gotten it between 5 and 10 times in 20 years, so maybe once every 2 years. But it happens. It's part of the game. I'm on the mats 4 days a week. It's going to happen.
Your old videos that I really appreciated, one piece of content that I got a lot out of was your work with Joe Lozo. So have you thought about maybe doing some more content with him in the future?
Absolutely, yeah. We were thinking about that. Just last week, my wife and I were talking about who else we could bring into the videos, and Joe is on the list. Rob Kahn, Agner Rocha, I've done stuff with. People like that. Hoyce Gracie, who lives in Florida now, who's not very far. Sarasota, I'm in Tampa. Get him in on some of the videos. So that's the future. You know, if you guys keep following me on Instagram or TikTok or YouTube or Facebook, you'll be seeing a lot of those. And I did a course with Joe Lozon a few years ago called Ultimate Grappling Hacks, which anybody can get at the my BJJ store that I have, thejujitsulifestyle.com. It's amazing. It's like all of his tricks. He's got a lot of awesome tricks that he's learned, and he's been training even longer than I have. He's been training since the 90s. He was fighting MMA in like 2000. Crazy. But he's still a good buddy of mine, and I definitely plan to have him back and do some more stuff with him.
What was your original work like with Rob Kahn? Would you say that was the most influential coach in your whole career?
Yeah, Rob Kahn, influential coach my whole career. We always joke, I say I was a crappy blue belt when I met him. I had I started under a blue belt who was pretty good. His name was Gary Goble. And he taught me up until, you know, blue belt. And then when I got my blue belt, I moved to, I was going to University of Tampa here in Tampa. But when I went home to New York, I would train with Gary. And then when I got down here to Tampa, I was training with a really good purple belt named Craig. And he, you know, he was a smaller guy. I mean, towards the end, we were pretty competitive. I was a blue belt, brand new blue belt. He was a purple belt, but just the size difference. You know, we talked about the 20 pounds in the 10 years. I was young and I was 180. He was maybe 10 years older than me. And, you know, maybe like 140, 150. So it was pretty competitive, even though he was way better than me, way more technical. And then that was about a year and a half in, I met Rob Kahn. The guy up in New York, Gary, who I train with, sent me an email. The email that really changed my life is said, there's a black belt under Hoyce Gracie. This was in 2004. He literally just got his black belt. He's moving to Tampa and he's opening up a school. You should contact him and train with him. And I was like, oh man, this is amazing. So I call him He answers. We get together. He didn't have a school just yet, but he had this little office space he had, and there was about five of us, the first five students under Rob, and we trained every day. They kicked my butt every day, and the rest is history, man. I figured I could stay where I am and get decent, or I could go with these guys and just try to get the sky's the limit.
So you had a lot of in-depth work with Rob Kahn. I want to ask you about the Gracies in general. How many of them have you met, and how much training have you done with the Gracie family?
So Hoist Gracie is really the only Gracie I have a relationship with, not because I don't want to, it's just that I haven't had the opportunity to meet many Gracies. But so Hoist, the gym that I trained at in New York was a Hoist Gracie network pool. So the blue belt that I'm learning under Gary was a Hoist Gracie blue belt. And Hoist would come once every year or two and teach a seminar there. He would go to other schools in New York, teach seminars. You know, that's what he does all year, even to this day, really. And so when he came to Conjures, New York, I went to a seminar there, and that's where I got my blue belt. And I was not able to roll with Hoist. I didn't really get any training with him. And then I went to another seminar in Clearwater when I was, I would say, at one stripe blue. And I got to roll with Hoist, and he just destroyed me. It was awesome. And he was, I have a video of it, and he was actually just, like, looking around, taking his time, just doing whatever he felt like. And I was there, like, fighting my butt off. Pretty humbling and cool to see that, to look back at that video. So really, honestly, that's the only training I really did with any Gracies. It's just Hoist Gracie, and we still have a good relationship to this day. He does seminars at the gym, and yeah, he's awesome.
If you've gotten to what people believe would be the pinnacle of jiu-jitsu, seeing that you're a black belt and you've got all your stripes and stuff, and someone like Gracie was able to kind of, you know, run through you, I want to ask you, what do you think is needed for your progression, seeing that you're teaching so many people? What about your learning? What do you think you need to do next to get to the next level?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not really too interested in competing anymore. The only thing I think I would really do from here on out is I really like that UFC Fight Pass card, the Invitational. I love that.
Agreed.
I know I'll be a part of that eventually. You know, I just got to put it out there. But other than that, like, my biggest jiu-jitsu goal was to make it to Abu Dhabi. It was like a 10-year goal that I got, and it was just amazing. I didn't win Abu Dhabi, but I won the trials. I made it to Abu Dhabi. I lost to a Russian guy named Rustam, who was just, like, awesome wrestler and really good at what we call anti-jiu-jitsu. He shuts down people's jiu-jitsu game and is able to outscore most people. So that was huge for me. Making it to the UFC was another big, big fighting goal I had. And so that, I guess you could say, I had an itch really bad, and it's now scratched, you know. And anytime I compete now, it's just going to be for fun. It's not to prove anything. It's not to, I'm 41 years old. I still feel fantastic. I still feel as good as I did when I was younger. But I'm just in a different part of life now. You know, I have three kids, a family, a couple of businesses and things I'm working on. And my goals just have shifted and changed. But yeah, I really do enjoy competition. I coach Billy Quarantillo, who's a UFC fighter. He's in the top 20 in the UFC. Matt Frivola, I coached for a very long time. He's in the UFC. And I'm more interested in seeing them succeed now than myself in the competition realm. But to keep me sharp, I have a plan for that. Like, so I'm all over the BJJ fanatics and learning from different people like Marcelo Garcia. He's still coming out with courses. The Gordon Ryans, the Danahers, I'm checking that kind of stuff out, although it's a little long-winded for me. I got to put it on like 2x speed for me to, my ADD to kind of focus in on that. But so I'm learning. And then every Thursday, what we have at my gym is an open pro training. Anyone in the whole area, anyone in Florida, anyone in the world can come to that training from 12:30 to 1:30, and we just do an hour of rolling. And all the best guys from all of our networks come to that training. And this is where I test myself, man, because there's guys that could beat me. There's guys that I beat all the time. There's guys that are just neck and neck, black belts from different schools, black belts from here. So I say that day of the week, that is that Thursday every week, I'm excited, I'm nervous, it still gives me that feeling. And you know, the more people that show up, the better. And I love testing myself with those guys, and it keeps me sharp. Like, I'm not going to make blue belt mistakes. You know, sometimes when you get your black belt, you only decide you want to roll with blue belts and just go easy and let them work. Like, not me. Like, I still roll with all my best guys every time. And I rarely say no. If somebody asks me to roll, I'm all over it. And until I don't feel like I can do that, that's the way it's got to be.
How did you meet Quarantillo and Steamroller?
Say that again?
How did you meet both of those fighters, Steamroller and Quarantillo?
How did I meet them? They came into my gym in 2010 on the same day, and they both had the same goal. They both wanted to be in the UFC. It was incredible. I wasn't even there. I was on an MMA cruise. I was teaching on a cruise, and they came in, and the guy that I had running the gym while I was gone, you know, when I got back, he's like, man, these two guys came in. They're pretty tough. One of them seems like he's a really good wrestler. The other one's just got great cardio. He's tough as nails. And yeah, man, they came in. They sparred the first day. They only had a couple months experience each. Matt Frivola came from Matt Serra's. He moved from New York to Tampa to go to school at University of Tampa, same place I went. Billy came down, same reason, to train with me. And to Billy went to University of Tampa. So she kind of knew what was going on with that, and so told him about my gym, and he came to train with us. And yeah, I told him, look, if you want to get to the UFC, it's not going to be easy. It's going to be hard. You got to put a decade of time in. You got to train through all sorts of life things. But if you stick with it, there's a chance. It's not even guaranteed, but there's a chance. And literally, those are the only two guys out of everybody that actually did it. We have a big slew of guys now that look like, you know, they're promising, but back then, these two guys stayed in for the long run, and now they're both.
So the next topic I want to talk about is street altercations. Have you ever been in a situation where someone didn't know that you were a veteran in the UFC, that you were black belt, and they tried to do something to you, and you had to use your BJJ experience?
My last fight, street fight, was when I was a purple belt. So I was not in the UFC yet, and I had just graduated college. It was 2005. But since then, no, man. Like, once you train, people know this. Once you get your blue belt or your purple belt, nobody really messes with you. And it's not even because they know you're a purple belt or a blue belt. It's more that they see the confidence. You're not uncomfortable in situations. You look people in the eyes. You're not a target, really. I mean, unless you're out and everybody's drinking and you put yourself into these, you know, stupid situations like that. Mainly, yeah, no, nothing. I'm not a street fighter. I don't like it. Especially nowadays, especially in Florida, everybody's carrying. There's no rules on carrying in Florida. Anyone can carry a gun right now, and everybody has them. So it's like, do I really want to risk, you know, my kids growing up without a dad because someone cut me off or someone called me a name? Like, it just doesn't make sense to me at this point. Back when I was in my 20s, you know, you have a little bit less patience for stuff like that, and, you know, you just test yourself. But I've got nothing to prove, man. Call me what you want. I'll be like, sorry, dude, my bad. I'll walk on. You hit me or you attack my family, that's probably a different story. You know, you're going to get hurt.
Let me ask you about an innovation in the MMA component of jiu-jitsu. The application of this choke has been seen more and more, a lot from Tajikistan fighters, a lot of Dagestan fighters. It's a way to get rid of someone that keeps on panic shooting or shooting on the fence, and it's the ninja choke. I saw your instructional about it. It's my go-to. I enjoy it the most. So do you like this choke, and how useful do you think it is?
Which choke are we talking about? The one where it's almost like a front naked choke? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, you cup them up and you put their neck here, and then you slap their head down into your chest, and then you rear naked choke and their head's stuck in their chest and you're pressing.
Yeah, I'm liking that a lot. I've seen different versions of it over the last 20 years, but a lot of people now are doing it in MMA, and they're doing it in the wrestling. Typically it would be like someone's trying to pass my guard and I'd throw their head in and lock it up, but now it's in the wrestling, which is, I think it's awesome, because there's only one way to get out of it. Everybody thinks that there is no grip fighting. If it's already locked in, the only way out is to corkscrew. You literally have to drop to your knees or your belly, drop your whole body, and spin your head at the same time. So your chin, instead of being facing the ground, is facing the ceiling, and you could kind of just spin yourself out. But if it's already in tight, it's like a 4 second choke. You know, you're in there 4 seconds, you're going out. It's just like a rear naked choke. I love it. I think it's great for takedown defense. You got to be very good at it though, because what I see a lot of people, the guillotine is a very interesting choke in MMA because it is responsible for people losing fights because people go for it and then they get taken down. Once you commit to a guillotine, you no longer have takedown defense. And in MMA, you know, you only have 3 rounds. And if someone beats you in that first round, you got to come back and win the next two if you're going to win a decision, or you got to finish them. So I would almost say, and I tell my guys, like, it's all strategy. If someone's taking me down in the first 4 minutes of the fight, I'm defending the takedown. I'm getting off the cage, going back to striking, or I'm trying to take him down. If there's 30 seconds or less left, I'm going for broke, man. I don't care if I get taken down. I'm going for chokes, anacondas, guillotines, because if I miss it, I got like 3 or 4 seconds and the bell's going to ring. You know, he didn't gain much time on top of me. I actually gained the advantage because I put him in a sub and I'm going to get points for that. So you do it in the beginning of a round and you miss it, and now he's on top of you the rest of the round. It's a 10-9 round. He wins. I got to win the next two. So I say be very careful with guillotines to my guys. We just did this last week. We talked about this 2 weeks ago. And I just told them, like, unless you're catching this guillotine on people in jiu-jitsu class all the time, and this is your move, don't go for it unless there's short time.
Let's talk about the defense to the ninja choke. You just said about the corkscrew, I believe. I think I need a little bit more explanation to that, seeing that I don't completely understand when it's locked in. As we know, it's like a 3 to 4 second blood choke. It's very powerful because it's when I was with my coach, I think his name's Olizion at the Melbourne Muay Thai Academy in Epping. He was talking about, he used to train at the Du Bronx gym in Sao Paulo, Brazil with Charles Oliveira. So he's trained with Charles for a decade. He was telling me that the reason that the ninja choke is so powerful is because when you have your guillotine and you're choking this part of the neck, or your rear naked choke where you're attacking both, with the ninja choke, you're kind of covering all surfaces because you got your arm underneath and you're attacking both sides. So it's hard to breathe out of one part of the neck. You can't really get your arm in there. After you do your sequence where you're telling me you drop down, what do you do next? Do you try and fight hand grips? What do you go for just in case you get caught in this?
Yeah, once you do that, I was going to move the camera so I could show you, but it's basically like I'm caught in it here. You know, like obviously you could do the tap, or you literally just, I'm not going to drop because I got cement here, but you literally just and drop at the same time. And normally what happens when I see guys do that is they get in terrible position, but who cares, right? Like you're about to tap. Mount me if you have to. Usually what happens is that you'll see them spin out, and I could show you a few examples. I could send you a couple videos later, but they spin out and the person gets top position and they're out. Like they're just out. The guy has to release because the guy's chin slipped out. So that's the only one I saw that's effective and consistent. Other than that, you know, you could try to fight the grips, but it's locked. It's like trying to fight an anaconda grip or a rear naked choke grip. It's already in. You're not pulling that hand off the top of the head, and because you're not facing, you know, it's over you. Like, you don't have strength here to pull that off, you know? So, yeah, it's a powerful choke, and that's why they call it the ninja choke, man. It's ninja.
That is so interesting that you even have a counter for it, seeing that with the fights that I watched, Tuco Tukos hit it in the road to UFC, I believe, before he even got in the UFC, and even now, Said Nurmagomedov, he's been hitting it. He's hit 2 in the UFC in, like, the first or second round, right? So I've never seen someone actually do that technique to get out of it. And the reason that I bring that up is because I said that I believe that the next generation of jiu-jitsu in MMA is applying this into the fights. And now that people are getting more used to the fact that people will be going for this when there's cage wrestling sequences, then they'll know how to get out of it. So do you think that it's just more of a lack of understanding, and now when people start learning more, people will realize how to do this? Because I've not seen a single person do that in the UFC yet for a ninja choke that has been locked in.
Yeah, it's fairly new in the MMA world. We've been doing it in jiu-jitsu for a long time, but in the MMA world with the wrestling, it's fairly new. So, yeah, somebody just has to say, put a video out. I guess I'll do it. I guess I'll be the guy and show how to get out of that. And that'll be in my next batch of videos. And then it catches on. People train it. Everybody gets used to that move. Everybody gets used to the defense. And then it's on to the next, you know, surprise technique. That's exactly how it works. That's how leg locks work. That's how the Barambola work. You know, everybody, deep half guard was such a huge thing at one point. We're like, how do you stop it? You know, leg locks. Now you see everybody getting out of the leg locks and everybody's calm. Nobody's really, nobody's really panicking anymore. So it's just the evolution of the game.
How funny is it that everybody had forgotten about the buggy choke all of a sudden?
Dude, that thing is, it's powerful, man. All my white belt students are going for it now. And I forget, I'm on side control with, you know, I call it control two, underhook and head control. And I'm like, oh, shoot. And if you don't get out quick, you're getting tapped to that by a white belt or anybody else who has flexible long legs who can lock that thing up. It is dangerous. I remember the first time I saw it in a long time, because it's not new, was when my fighter, Matt Frivola, was fighting Bob Ross, they call him, the violent Bob Ross. I forget his name. Anyway, the guy with the Afro puff. And he put him, Matt had side control, and he put him in it, and I was like coaching him. I'm like, I just looked at it for a few seconds. I'm like, oh, shoot. And luckily, Frivola just postured up and just toughed out of it and kind of slammed him. You can't really do that in jiu-jitsu, but he got out. But he was, afterwards, you saw, like, he was almost out. So it's a dangerous choke. And again, there's ways to stop it. Like, if you know a guy's good at it, I would never do that control position. I'd go to the one where you put the hand over the head and hand on the hip, and or go into like a case of katami, you know. I'm not going to mess around with that.
Interesting question, but how has jiu-jitsu helped you with your parenting?
Man, that's a great question. Jiu-jitsu has helped me in every area of my life because it's made me a more calm person under pressure, right? You got some 250-pound guy with chest hair and fat in your face, you know, taking every orifice, your mouth, your eyes, and you got to turn your head and breathe, and you got to relax, you got to stay calm. You know, it allows me to stay calm in turbulent situations. And kids, we have three kids, so there's fights every day in my house, you know, and where most people maybe would just freak out and, I'm able to better stay calm. Hey, guys, relax. They see that I'm confident. You know, jiu-jitsu makes you confident. I don't care what anybody says. If they watch me, my confidence, they're going to model that. They're not going to do what I tell them to do. They're going to do what I do, right? So if they see a confident man who can protect their family, they feel safe, they feel nurtured, that's what you want. You know, you want to model that for your kids. You don't want to model insecurity. You know, you don't want your son to look up and be like, oh, I wonder if my dad could protect our family if somebody ever came into our house. Like, you want them to be like, oh, dad's a ninja. You know, I don't feel any anxiety right now. You know, that's what you want. Those are probably the main ways. And luckily, you know, we have a gym, and my all three of my kids train jiu-jitsu. So not only are they watching me train, they're training themselves, and they don't get it yet as far as like why I wouldn't say forcing, but coaxing them to do it, bribing them to do it every, you know, a couple times a week. But I always tell them, you guys, when you're like 14, you're going to be like, oh, or 15, you're going to be like, dad, I get it. Thank you. Because a lot of times kids, they don't want to do it anymore. They want to go do something else. They want to do what they want to do. They don't want to do what's hard, right? Adults too, right? So luckily I'm there to help them and guide them into doing it. None of their friends are doing that. But none of their friends are doing hard stuff. They're playing on their video games all day. My kids are in the grind, trying to get out of someone's guillotine and trying not to tap and trying to pass and really exerting their energy. And you know, sometimes they lose and they got to deal with that mentally. Man, I lost. How do I get back in there now? Oh, I hurt my nose. Like, kids are so susceptible, and they're so like pain hurts really bad for kids. Like last night I had to take a needle and stick my son in his little, it looked like a little staff thing going. And I wanted to pop the bubble. And man, it was like I was killing him. Like, no, this is so painful. So like just dealing with that, the pain, and moving forward and toughening your body up and toughening your mind up, I think that's going to lead them into adulthood the right way and give them confidence to handle any tasks or any problems.
What submission do you think that beginners fail the most? Do you think it's like a triangle, armbar? What would you say you see beginners failing their submission? Which one is it?
It's a good question. The Americana seems to be the easiest for everybody in the beginning. Guillotine seems to be pretty easy for people. The one that I think they fail the most on, probably the armbar, really. It's just they kind of confuse the armbar and the triangle together because it's both has to do with putting the legs up over the shoulders. So in the very beginning, even with my kids and, you know, adults, I say throw up a triangle. Sometimes they throw up an armbar. And when I say throw up an armbar, they get those two confused so much. So I'd say armbar and triangle together, you know, they confuse them and they kind of mix them into one and they make like a new submission that's not really a submission. Like they'll throw the leg over the head, but the guy's arm is already out and they're trying to armbar the top arm. And I see that a lot. And no matter how many times you show them, it just takes like a good year for them to really, really hone that one in for some reason. But it's a little confusing. What? A lot of steps.
What benefits do you think that the lasso guard has over something like your regular closed guard?
I'm not a big lasso guy. Maybe because I came from, you know, I started in the gi. We didn't do a whole lot when I started. And then it was more, went back to no gi for MMA. And now since 2010, I went back into the gi. So a lot of my students play it. I teach some of it. It's just harder to get out of, right? Like, you wrap up someone's arm in lasso, they're easier to sweep. Like, they can't base. It's hard for them to get their arm out. They're playing with one arm. If you go to a spider on the other side, you know, you can pretty much sweep them if they don't know how to get out of the, you know, if they can't break the grips. So the my students who do it really well, just a pain in the ass, man. It's like, you know, they make it really hard for you to get it out, and they get their sweeps from there. So I would say the close guard is a lot easier to just open and pass through. And then the lasso, it's a specialty guard. Like, if you don't know exactly how to break that grip, it's going to be pretty tough. Just more opportunities for sweeps.
Coach, what message do you have to people that either want to quit BJJ? Have you ever been in a position where you wanted to quit?
I have never been in a position where I considered quitting ever. My first class was March 8th, 2003, and I've been training pretty consistently ever since. I took a little time off after I got my blue belt for one reason or another, and then pretty consistent since then. So if you want to quit, I mean, just really think about why that is. If it's just because it's hard and you're still a white belt, I would say stick in there until you're like a couple stripe blue belt, because it gets really good and really fun once you start to get more proficient and you start to be able to tap out the new crop of white belts that come in. And don't think just because higher belts are tapping you all the time that you suck. It's not the case. They're just good. And you have to use that as motivation, because you can get that good. It doesn't matter if you're strong, small, man. Like, when I first started, there was a guy named Joey. He was probably 130 pounds and he looked like Harry Potter. And he destroyed me. Like, I was like, oh my gosh, how could this be? You know, like, it's technique, and you can use what you have to succeed in jiu-jitsu. So if you're under like a two stripe blue belt, I would say stick it out and keep going and then see, because usually by about two stripe blue, you kind of see where you're going to be at. You get the skills, you're tapping people out that are underneath you in different belt, you know, white belt, brand new blue belts. And then it becomes fun. It's not fun the first year. I mean, you enjoy it and you see the potential and it's cool, but it's way more fun to tap people than to get beat up every single class. So if you're quitting because of that, because you're getting beat up every class, I would say stick it out a little longer and see if you're enjoying, you know, if you enjoy the art. If you just hate it and everything about it, I mean, don't do stuff you hate, right? But there are so many benefits. Yeah, you'll get hurt here and there. You might get a staph infection here and there. But you can get hurt doing anything, you know, get hurt in cooking class, burn your hand, whatever. So just give it a shot and stick with it a little longer and play it out a little longer, I would say.
Your instructional on the Ezekiel choke, was a little bit interesting to me with you putting three fingers into the gi. Can you explain this technique? I really liked it. I really liked it that you how you explained it. And do you land this a lot in your training?
I love that choke. Land it quite often. I just landed it yesterday, actually. It's almost always there, especially when you're going for the back and you're digging your hand under that armpit. It's almost always there. The three fingers is because I could still get a great grip with three fingers, but I have more wrist flexibility with three fingers. If I put all four fingers in, at least my wrist doesn't bend the way I need it to get that over. But when I have three in there, it's just a little more mobile for my wrist. And maybe people who have super flexible wrists, it won't matter. But I find I can still get a good grip, and I can get more flexibility to get this bent and then that over the neck. But yeah, I use that all the time. I think I first saw that maybe 10 years ago from Keenan Cornelius back in the day when he was killing everybody everywhere. Maybe a little less than 10 years, 8 years ago. I've seen the Ezekiel from the Mount, where you just lock the head and throw this over the neck and things like that. And I never had much success with that. And then this one, I'm having tons of success because a lot of my game is to take the back. And when you're taking the back, you put your right arm under their right arm to get the seatbelt grip. And instead of that, I'll just, oh, there it is. And I like to get that finish. And if I can't get it, the reason I love it too is if you don't get it, you don't really lose much. You just, okay, it didn't work. Let me try passing now.
How would you define the art of jiu-jitsu?
Define the art of jiu-jitsu. I mean, translation of the word in Japanese is the gentle art. I would define it as, using leverage and technique to get a great position to where you're safe and you can't get hit and you can't get submitted. And the choice, you have the choice now, do I want to be brutal or do I want to be nice? And I love that because no real other art has that. If I'm a karate expert, I gotta knock you out if I'm gonna hurt you. There's really no, like, I guess you can just back away and defend other people's punches, but you're not really winning that fight. You're not really controlling that fight. You're just defending. But name me another art where you could literally, like, I had an MMA fight on The Ultimate Fighter against Troy Mandolones. I got hit one time. I barely hit, like, we didn't hit each other. I took him down. I got side control. He elbowed me in the face. That was his only punch. I didn't really hit him at all, and I took an arm bar and I won the fight. You know what I mean? Like, it's what other art can you say that? So it's really just power of decision. Like, I have the power to hurt you, or I have the power to show mercy, control you, wait till help comes, and just say, "Hey, man, get out of here." And I love that because, with that.
So, Brazilian tap. I was rolling in a tournament. I was a purple belt. It was like my fifth tournament, and it was after I started to really feel like I was getting, better at jiu-jitsu, and I was about to start MMA, and I was rolling with this guy named Edson Diniz, Diniz, and he was famous for in the World Championships in the year 2000. He was in the finals against BJ Penn the year BJ Penn won it. He lost to BJ Penn on points, but he made it to the finals. He was really good. And this was, obviously years later, 5 years later, I was competing against him, no gi. And I got him in an ankle lock. I pressed it hard, and you could see it on the recording that he gave me one of these. So I let go, and he came right back into my guard, and I was like, "Oh." And I'd always heard about the Brazilian tap, and then that right there, I experienced it. And yeah, you can see it on the footage. It's on YouTube. And I ended up submitting him anyway. That's instant karma, I guess you could say. But in the moment, I was like, this is bull crap. I won. And now I still have to keep going. And then Rob Kahn was coaching me, go, 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 get him. And I put him in an omoplata. He got out, and I turned it into a triangle. And then I saw his arm hanging out, and I took the arm bar from the triangle. And that was the first match where I really felt, okay, I could do this either for a living, or I could fight. I feel pretty good. And then the next match, I had another black belt, and I beat him in the finals. And that was the first time I had ever tapped any black belts, and it was pretty cool. And then I fought shortly after, and the rest is history.
probably your most viral piece of content was you explaining your favorite move, which was you grab the arm, you do the sequence, which ends up with them, you know, trying to defend, you do the grips, and then you somehow you get the back control and you have them in the position you like. Have you added any new nuances to your favorite positional move in jiu-jitsu?
So yeah, that was probably the second biggest viral. The first one was the Batista bomb. That got like a couple million hits for obvious reasons. But yeah, so that move I've been doing since I was a blue belt. The only thing I really changed, and I didn't show it because I want to make these clips pretty quick, but when I push the wrist down and they go to grab it and then I lock the gift wrap in, I take my foot, the one that's mounted, and I slide it up to the floating ribs before I sit into the stargaze to take them over for the body triangle. And because I go up 3 or 4 inches, instead of just staying on their hip bones like most people do, I go up. I get the tap most times right from the body triangle without even getting the choke in. I just squeeze steady pressure. And one of two things happen. They start like making noises, like, and then I know I got them. Or because they're not making noises, their chin comes up because they're suffocating, and then I take the rear naked choke. So I love it. It works. Anytime I get them out, every time I roll, that's the first thing I try. And if it doesn't work, I'll go to something else like the head arm triangle or something like that.
I saw your video and it was, you said something about there's some people that end up in the same positions. If it's a bad position or if it's a good position, there are things that you like, habits that you have that cause yourself to fall into a particular position. I'll tell you what my one is. So I find myself in a north-south position with me on bottom. Every roll I've done in the last month, I've ended up with someone on top of me in north-south. Now, sometimes I get on top, and that's why I was trying to figure out how to do that, what's it called, the shoulder ripper. I was trying to figure out how to get that grip to, you know, attack from that position, seeing that it's a underutilized position with offense. So let's say I'm on bottom and they're on top of me. What do you recommend that I should be doing to defend, either get off, sweep them, into a better position? What is your go-to
if someone's getting north south all the time on me?
On me, yes.
And you, so number one, you could stop them from going to north south by just making a frame on their hip. So anytime they try to walk towards your head, you just walk your feet, you just follow them, and you hold them at their hip so they can't just, you know, kind of beat you. You slow them down and you just walk, so that kind of keeps them there. But if they actually do get north south, I have a pretty explosive wrestling ability, even though I never really wrestled before MMA. So what I like to do is if someone goes north-south, I will literally just make a cross on my hands to one of their legs. So I'll be here. He'll be behind me. I'll cross my hands. I'll pick a leg. And then as I turn to my belly, it turns into me locking up their leg, and I go right into a single. They have to move, because if they don't move, I'm going to tackle them, right? So I basically just... I push them, give them space, and then I roll my belly and grab one of their legs, and either they're going to try to come around and take my back, in which case, as long as I have a leg, they can, or they're going to come around and roll to my own back to avoid that, and I'm their way. They have to make a reaction. If I roll on my belly and go after one of their legs, they have to make a reaction. Now, can it be hard to go to your belly when he's chest to chest on you and north-south? Yeah, of course, which is why you got to kind of rock and move and create a little bit of space first, but... It's very, very doable. So that's what I do. And the other thing you can do literally is just nothing. And just keep your elbows tight, and they go to north-south. If they try to set up, I don't know if you're doing gi or no gi, but if they're trying to set up a gi choke, just make sure you keep your eyes on that. If they're trying to set up a north-south choke, just make sure your hands are close to your neck and you defend that. They're going to get bored. There's not much they can do. And what they're probably going to try to do from the north-south is either try to step over and mount you, you know, kind of walk back to side control and try to mount you. You know, or they're going to try to dig under your arms for Kimuras and things like that. And as long as you're ready for all that, if they find they cannot get you, they're going to go back to side control, because that's where they feel more comfortable. And then that's an easier escape than north-south, because at least their hips are right next to your legs. You can start going to elbow escapes and things like that. But sometimes the best thing to do is nothing. Just stay safe and do nothing and see what they do. they'll realize it's not going to work, and then they go to another position, and you can kind of stop them in the transition.
What about if you have someone that has a sound understanding of the wrestling component and you go to grab their leg, as you told me before, what happens if they just keep on sprawling on me? What do you go for after that sequence?
Yeah, anytime someone's a better wrestler and my single or double is not working, I just fall back to a half guard or a guard. Typically, if I have his leg in my hand, I could decide to drive into him. But if he's sprawling and he's just too good, I fall backwards and I grab his leg and I place it between my legs and I get my underhook right there. So yeah, and you see it in MMA all the time. You watch any of Damian Maia's fights. He shoots a double and then he pulls it right into a half guard. And from the half guard, he's on your back because he's just that good at that.
What principle of jiu-jitsu do you think that MMA fighters are lacking?
MMA fighters, principle of jiu-jitsu. That's a great question. I would have to say most of them are pretty damn good. Like, they're scrambling. Even the wrestlers who aren't like jiu-jitsu guys, they scramble so well to get back to their feet. You see a lot of people not be able to escape the back very well, or the mount, the back and the mount. Usually when they're mounted, they give the back up. Which I think is a good strategy sometimes in MMA, because I'd rather any day of the week, I'd rather someone on my back than mounted in an MMA fight, because they can't land those brutal strikes. But yeah, when someone's mounted in MMA, you typically see them turn their back and give up their back instead of just elbow escape. Just do the elbow escape you learned as a white belt, you know, and it's a lot more nerve wracking to do that elbow escape because you got punches being thrown at you. But if you knock them down, their hands are on the mat, you hold them tight, you know, you dig tight, and then you start working that elbow escape. What we do at our school for the MMA guys is something I call the power elbow escape. And it's literally where you take two hands to one of their knee and you almost turn completely to give them your back. I'm probably going to make a video on this. And you lift your butt up so that their legs come off the ground, and then you push that knee right into the half guard. And you, since you're turned, they can't really land the big shots on your face. Matt Frivola does this very well. Billy Q does this very well. We've been practicing it forever. But yeah, I would say just basic escapes from the mount. Instead of giving up your back, just get back to a guard. And, because once you give your back, yeah, you're not getting your head beat in, but now he has the chance to rear naked choke you. And if he puts a body triangle in, he's probably going to keep that for the rest of the round, and you're going to lose the round. At least if you get back to a guard, you could use the guard to get up. You could use the guard to submit him and finish him, or you can, you know, use the guard to land, you know, elbows or whatever. So,
how overpowered do you think wrestlers would be if they were able to understand getting the hooks in on the back positions? Because someone like even Kamaru Usman and someone like Michael Chandler, they're wrestlers and they get really good shots off. See what?
Yep. So as I was saying about Usman and Chandler, they get really good positions where you would think if they're on the cage and they have the back, you would think putting the hooks in and immediately being a good jiu-jitsu back control specialist, kind of similar to how Aljamain Sterling implemented his game. I think the more wrestlers that do this, you would be the most overpowered fighter on the planet. So how many, this is a hard question, but how much success do you think wrestlers would have in MMA if they had a really good hook game and really good back mount game?
I think it would be a home run, because the reason they don't do it is two reasons. They're so used to getting that one hook in, and that they call it like the leg ride or whatever they call it, and they can land ground and pound from there, and that's where they're comfortable, because they come from a wrestling background, and that's all they did when they got that position. I know they feel that if they got two hooks in, and this is what a lot of wrestlers have told me, when they get two hooks in, they feel like that the guy's going to escape. Like, they don't feel comfortable with the two hooks. But if they just did do it, you get like someone like Khabib, who, yeah, he's behind you all the time with that body lock. He'll drag you to the floor. He'll let you get tired. You keep trying to get up. He keeps dragging you down. Then when he feels it, he will throw the hooks in. He'll get the mount off of it. He likes that position on top where he traps your top leg and just triangles it, and he just beats you up from the Dagestani handcuff, which I think is a great position. But yeah, if they can just get hooks in with their hip power from wrestling, if they can just flatten you out with that and just like Matt Hughes used to do really well, he would get the back flattened, like, you know, him and Hoist Gracie, same kind of thing, flatten you out and just pound your temples in and your ears in. I think if they can just get that down, it's a home run, because they're so good at coming behind and getting the back on the wrestling portion of it. And they're so used to that, that if they could just somehow learn to get the hooks in and be comfortable there with the controls, because at the end of the day, if the guy gets out, they could probably salvage and get the mount from the back. Usually they just don't want to end up on their back. So typically when someone has the back with the hooks in, if the other person can get them on their back, get their back to the floor, they could turn into their guard. And that's the last place a wrestler wants to be. So they don't even risk it. But if they can just get comfortable there, they're Khabib, you know, or they're the other one, the champion right now at 55, Islam Makhachev, you know, they'll be like those guys.
Let me ask you about that Russian anti-jiu-jitsu style that was aforementioned. You were talking about it previously on the show just before. What do you do to kind of try and get rid of the anti-jiu-jitsu style? How do you make them play the game?
It's hard, man. It's I mean, the only experience I really have physically from it is rolling against Rustam in Abu Dhabi. And if you go back and watch the match, it went the full 10 minutes and then it went the full 5 minutes overtime. And he's just an incredible wrestler, way better wrestler than I am. So I didn't really want to be on the feet with him. He wanted to be on the feet. He wanted to get the takedown. So for me to try to stop that, I pulled guard. So that's one thing you can do is stay out of their wrestling game, because you will get thrown. You'll get snapped down so hard, you get discouraged sometimes. So I pulled guard. And then he wasn't really, at least for jiu-jitsu, he wasn't really trying hard to pass. I felt like I stopped every pass pretty easily. Like I never felt at risk that he was going to get side control. And I knew what he was doing. It's the anti-jiu-jitsu. It's like fake the pass, let the time run out. Because at least in Abu Dhabi, in the overtime, you're not allowed to pull guard. You have to wrestle. So that's what he was doing. He did it to me that day. He did it to Lovato. He did it to, he was doing it to Keenan Cornelius. Like, it was incredible. He used that game to beat almost all of us. He ended up losing to Cornelius in the finals, or in the semifinals. But man, I would say play guard. I almost had him in a triangle at one point in overtime, but he just knew, you know. And then actually when he lost that year, he did get triangled. So, you know, if he gets too aggressive with the pass, the best thing you can do, if you can, is put them on their back. Because a great wrestler like that does not want to be there, and it would probably be an easy pass. He'd probably roll to his belly. You'd probably get his back. But good luck, you know, because the Russians wrestling there is just incredible. You're not putting them on their back. So play the guard, go after their legs, attack their legs. But a lot of the Russians are good at sambo, so they do a lot of legs. Yeah, man, your guess is as good as mine. I just tried my best to stay out of the wrestling game. And just make it so that he wanted to pass, and maybe he makes a mistake. And he made a mistake once, but he was able to explode out of my triangle. But he ended up getting caught in a triangle that exact same way. So somebody got him.
What's it about jiu-jitsu? What's it about the mentality of jiu-jitsu that allows these masters to live very fulfilled long lives that are very healthy? Because I've seen so many jiu-jitsu practitioners that reach the age of 80, even going on 90, and they still look relatively fit compared to everybody else in their age bracket. So what do you think that is with the mentality in jiu-jitsu? What's causing that?
There is a, and I don't have all of them in my head, but there is a thing that Tony Robbins says that makes people happy. It's the six human needs. And I did a video on this, not recently, but many years ago. Jiu-jitsu covers every one of those six needs. And I'll name a few of them that I know off memory, but I'll be missing a couple. Certainty, right? So when you go to jiu-jitsu, there are some certainty, right? Like, you know, there's going to be a warm-up. You know, there's going to be some technique. You know, there's going to be class. You know what to expect. Uncertainty. People need uncertainty. Every role is different, right? Even though there's a structure of the class and you know what to expect, during each role, you have no clue what to expect. It could be anything. It could be somebody could be on their game that day and tap you out three times. The next day, you could tap them out three times. So that uncertainty is just awesome for our brains.
and our overall happiness. We like that uncertainty. Growth, being able to grow in something, even as a black belt, I learn stuff every single time I roll. Every single time I'm in class, I learn something. I'm like, oh man, why didn't I do that before? Or if you're watching videos, you can grow in this art, right? You can grow. There's growth. You grow as a person. You grow as a martial artist. Contribution is another one. Man, like as a teacher, so these guys that make it to 80, and even if you're just a coach, you don't own the school, but you're coaching, you're helping, you are contributing to people. And it's not just on the mat. Like, I can't tell you how many people come to my office with personal problems. I try to help, you know, if I have experience in that problem, I try to help. But I am contributing every day to somebody's life in a positive way. And that makes me feel better. And that makes me feel like I'm doing something. Uncertainty, certainty, growth, contribution. There's two more, and I forget what they are, but jiu-jitsu filled both of those, all six of them. So if you want to Google this, Google Tony Robbins, six human needs, and jiu-jitsu, for me at least, fills all of them. And I think for all everybody who trains, they could see how that could fulfill all of those. So if you can fulfill all six of those throughout your whole life until you're 80, 90 years old, it gives you more purpose. It gives you more like a mission. It gives you more zest for life, and I believe it helps you live longer. It definitely helps you stay healthier. It's obvious reasons. We don't want to get destroyed on the mat. We want to have longevity. We want to have better cardio, so we train harder. We eat better. We try to have every advantage we can have. We lift weights. We you know, just live that jiu-jitsu lifestyle. If you look out in my backyard, I have a cold plunge and a I have a cold plunge and a sauna right there. Why do I do that? Right? Because I have a little trampoline there. It spreads the lymph. Like, it's a healthy lifestyle. Like, this is it, man. So it's like one feeds the other. Like, you don't want to get tapped out. It's usually how it starts. So people stop smoking cigarettes. They stop smoking weed. They stop drinking so much. They stop partying so much. They want to have better performance on the mat. And then that just snowballs. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And it just turns into something that is a habit. And you do that habit for long enough, your heart's healthier, your body's healthier, your cholesterol's great, and you live longer and you're happier. You have a more fulfilled life.
How important are wrist locks in jiu-jitsu for the transition component of the sport, seeing that, of course, you're not going to really tap people with a wrist lock, but let's say, how important is it for when you need to get a different position on someone to chuck one on quickly to get into the position that you want to get into?
So I have a course called Wrist Locks Revealed, and it's 20 of the best wrist locks in jiu-jitsu, and it's the ones I use every single time I roll. And I do get many taps, and if I don't get a tap, they move in a situation or they move into a position where I can get another submission. And it's great for transitions. It's great for, it just doesn't get you a lot of friends. People don't like to get wrist locked. And every time I do it, people are like, half of them are like, oh man, I didn't see that coming. Or, oh man, that's messed up. And I'm like, sorry, man, don't leave your wrists out and don't leave them limp. People do jiu-jitsu like this all the time. Like, they're, I'm like, oh man, that's perfect for the taking. So wrist locks are my specialty for sure. I'm kind of known for wrist locks. I have a couple very unique setups that I've never seen anywhere. I love wrist locks so much. I'm looking for them for every position. I have a rear naked choke setup I do from a wrist lock, you know, and I just love them. They're everywhere. And again, if you watched, Gary Tonin got beat by wrist lock in Abu Dhabi when he was facing Matthias Denise. It was insane. Pablo Popovich tapped out to a wrist lock from Marcelo Garcia in Abu Dhabi. Like, this stuff happens. Actually, the Matthias Denise one and Tonin, that might not have been Abu Dhabi. It might have been the Worlds or something, but it's sneaky and nobody wants a broken wrist. That would suck. You can't do the things you want to do. You can't train. So it comes on quick and you either rip it out and leave something else open. Like, for example, the easiest one, I'm going for an armbar on you and you're doing this or you're doing this. I'm not going for the armbar. I'm not going to break that strong grip. I'm bending that and you're going to release and you're going to give me the armbar. I love him. I can't say enough good things about him. I tried to make like a joke. You know how John Danaher says something like, why would you ignore 80% of the body, you know, for leg locks? Well, the wrist is like 5%. Like, why would you ignore 5% of the body? You know, go for them. I was going to make a t-shirt, but anyway, they're awesome.
Let's talk about your academic career. How is your science helps you in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu?
It's a good question. I wouldn't say I'm an academic. I mean, I love reading books. I read books every day, and I did go to college, which I would not recommend to anyone unless they want to be a doctor or a lawyer or something that college, you know, you have to go to college to do that. I think it's a waste of money. I don't think you need it in this day and age with the internet and all the opportunities that young kids have. And I think a lot of the kids nowadays are starting to see that. Anyway, that's besides the point. I don't know. I don't think science has helped me with my jiu-jitsu at all. I mean, the only thing I like about academics, you know, in colleges, I should say, is that it got me to Florida and to Tampa, because I went to University of Tampa to play baseball, and it got me to Rob Kahn, which helped, you know, change my life. I didn't like paying $80,000 in loans until I was 35. That wasn't fun.
I've seen this so many times. Someone gets into the armbar position and they're holding on for dear life. They're holding on here, and the other person's yanking and yanking and they can't get it off. Now you put your foot on there and you can push it off, right? But let's say they're stuck there. How important is learning the bicep slicer to then either finish the fight or get the armbar that you want to get? How important is that?
Yeah, I mean, some guys, you're just not going to break their grip. They're just too strong and they're holding their wrist too tight. You can't get the wrist lock, and you could sit there and go back to mount and try something else, or you can try the bicep slicer. So I would say if it's short time and you really need to get that arm, and you go for it. I think it's important, because no matter how strong you are, that bicep slicer is going to hurt. And if you want to have a sore arm for a couple weeks, you know, don't tap. But if you want to, you know, get free, you tap. Another thing I do that's pretty cool, and I'm going to show this in a video. I learned this when I think I was a white belt. But so let's say he's doing this and he gets his elbow to the floor under your groin. There's no more arm bar unless you could lift the elbow back up, right? So as he does that and gets his elbow to the floor, I take my right foot, if I'm on his right arm, and I put it between his legs instead of on his hip. And I let them come up, and they come up right into a beautiful knee bar. And it's freaking slick and it's tricky. I actually did it yesterday as well. This guy just kept getting his elbow to the floor, and I just couldn't keep his elbow on top of my groin. He's so powerful, and he just ripped it to the floor. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to lose everything. Instead, I put my right foot between his legs. And as he came up into my guard, he came up into a knee bar. And it just starts the whole leg lock game. It was no gi. And so I'll do that too. But you won't gain a lot of friends with bicep slicers, with wrist locks in your school, because they both hurt really badly, and they're embarrassing to tap to. So
tell me about the story where you have a photo with Joe Rogan. What was he like?
Oh yeah. So Joe Rogan is awesome. He's actually mentioned me a couple times on his podcast, which anytime Joe Rogan says your name, it's awesome, because he has so many people listening to him. He was interviewing Matt Brown, and I was Matt Brown's first MMA fight in the UFC. And we actually fought twice. We fought before that as well. So he said something like, you know, when you were fighting your first fight in the UFC, you fought Matt Arroyo, who's really good at jiu-jitsu, good grappler, you know, still is a good grappler. So he's just saying all those cool things. It was awesome. So I, you know, try to write him and say, thank you for mentioning me, blah, blah, blah. And then when I was coaching, and then of course I fought in the UFC and I won a couple fights. So he was the guy saying, hey, what do you think about this? So those are our exchanges, you know, like he interviewed me for a post-fight interview, and he mentioned me on the podcast. But then Who's Number One, which is a really good grappling event put on, Flow Grappling and Who's Number One. I had a girl, Erin Harp, who is incredible grappler, female. She beat one of Andre Galvao's girls, who happened to be number two at the time. And I went out there to coach her. She wins. It was pretty cool. Anyway, Joe Rogan's there. It was in Austin, Texas. Joe Rogan lives there. And I just saw him, and I had to go up to him and say, just like everybody else wanted to go up to him, and just started talking with him. And he knew who I was, and we were chatting, and, you know, he asked me what I've been up to, and nothing crazy. I mean, I wish I could say that we're buddies and we hang out on weekends, but it's not the case. But we, yeah, I was like, let's do a picture. So we got the picture, and he's just a great guy. He's exactly how he is on his podcast. Just, he's one of those guys where everyone in the world wants to be his friend because you feel like you already know him, and he's a cool dude. He looks like he's fun to hang out with. So nothing but respect. Black belt, really good striker, really good announcer, you know, commentator.
When I researched your Wikipedia, I did see that you had fought Matt Brown twice, and I found that very interesting. That's my brother's favorite fighter, by the way. So what do you remember from these fights? I know these were tough fights for you, but what do you remember from it? Was it more that you struggled with yourself, or do you feel like the best man won that night? How do you feel about these fights?
Okay, so Matt Brown, yeah, he is an incredible fighter. He was just born and bred to fight, really. I mean, he had an overdose of heroin, and he survived that. Like, he's just a tough dude. And I had never fought anybody. The first time we fought, I had never fought anybody even remotely as tough as him and as durable and good as him, because I only had one fight. So my first fight was 48 seconds, and I won by rear naked choke. Now, going from that to Matt Brown, who had a bunch of fights at the time, he was like a last second replacement for me. My opponent backed out at weigh-ins, and I was like, well, I see a guy with cauliflower ear, let's ask him if he'll fight, because I wanted to do a fight. He agreed, and I was like, I should have known right then and there, like, only a badass is gonna agree right then and there, or someone who's not good, but it turned out to be a badass. What I remember is, no matter what I did, no matter how many times I hit him, how many submission attempts I did, he just kept coming forward, and he was not discouraged at all. That's what I remember from both fights. So that was the first fight. He ended up in – they both pretty much went the exact same way. I did pretty good in the first round, controlled the fight most of the round. He started coming back towards the end. You know, we go between rounds. Round two comes out. I try my best, and he freaking just ends up winning. I got exhausted in both of them. More exhausted than I had ever been in any fight in both of those fights, especially the first one, because I had no experience. But the second one, I remember between rounds, at the end of round one, he landed a good knee on me in the chin, and my eyes literally went crossed, and they stayed that way. And I'm like, oh, that's going to suck if that stays like that after the fight. And then I fought a little bit harder, and then I'm sitting between rounds, and Rob's talking to me, and I'm tired. Not exhausted, but tired, just like every fight. You know, you get tired between rounds. And Rob's talking to me. And all I remember is, like, I got to get my eyes back to, you know. And all of a sudden, within, like, when they clicked that little thing for everyone to get up and get out and get back, my eyes went back to normal. And I'm like, oh, thank God. And what most people don't know about the second fight is he threw a flying knee somewhere in, like, the first minute. And as I was backing up, I rolled over my ankle and completely broke my ankle, right? And if you go back and rewind it and you pause it at the moment he throws the jumping knee and I'm backing up and you pause it, you see me standing on my ankle. My ankle's on the floor and my foot's off to the side. So then I shot a takedown because I was like, shoot, if I don't get him to the ground, this is it. This is my chance. And he defended it. So I just pulled guard because I didn't feel like I could stand anymore. And he had the best what I remember perfectly is he had really good posture. Like, he knew not to let me pull him in. And then he just kept posturing up and landing big shots and posturing up. And then I started taunting him. Every time he hit me, I'm like, ah, that didn't do anything. Oh, you know, I was messing around, you know, giving him one of these. And then he put me on the cage and put two or three together. And I was kind of like out, but not out. Like, one of them put me out. One of them woke me up and they stopped the fight. But, yeah, I just remember no matter what I did, I landed really big shots on him. I gave him a black eye, a bloody nose. I landed a good body shot that hurt him. I've had mount on him. He got out. Like, everything I did, he just had an answer for, and he just kept coming forward. And, you know, truly, I've had eight total fights. Two of my three losses were to him. And he's the only guy I feel like that truly beat me. Like, you know, obviously I won five fights. The other loss was a split decision. It could have went either way. I wasn't beat. I wasn't mentally done. I was fine. At the end of the fight, you know, we celebrated. He's the one guy that beat me. And the other thing I thought was, like, if this was a jiu-jitsu match, I'd probably beat him in a jiu-jitsu match. But since it's MMA and he's got his, you know, his power and all that stuff and his striking and his cardio, you know, he's got me there. But jiu-jitsu, I think I got him. I think that would be a fun match, like a UFC fight pass type match. I would take that in a second.
Let's talk about the arm in and arm out guillotine. I want to ask you specifically for MMA usage, what are the pros and cons between the two, and what do you think MMA fighters should be going for?
I like the arm in guillotine for MMA because it's very slippery. You see a lot of guys just go for the head and they slip out. They have no shirts on. There's sweat everywhere. At least if you have an arm and a head, you have two parts of the body that are controlled and underneath your arms. And I have more success nowadays with the arm in guillotine in MMA and in jiu-jitsu when I'm training. It's just I think it's just a safer thing to do. A lot of times you see guys go for just the head and they on the takedown it slips right out. But typically on a takedown from a front headlock, I can hang on to him and have a chance to keep my wrist under the throat and get the choke. So my thing for MMA is the arm in, and you see it finished an awful lot, right? Like they get it, their head gets tucked into their belly. These guys either give up mount or they tap. So I'll take either one of those.
Final question for the show. How important was the ADCC gold medal in 2014? Is this the best, most fulfilling achievement of your career, or would you say that something else was better than that?
So just to correct you a little bit, it's the Abu Dhabi trials, right? So I never won Abu Dhabi, the because I like I said, I lost to Rustam in when in the actual Abu Dhabi. So the Abu Dhabi trials is like Olympic trials, right? You win that, you get to go to the big show. It's like a tryout for the UFC, pretty much, like, but it's for Abu Dhabi. So ADCC is the best and most prestigious title tournament for no-gi grappling in the world, right? It's bigger than no-gi worlds. It's bigger than anything. When I was a blue belt, I watched my coach try to get in, and his big goal was Abu Dhabi, and he got me into it, and he had me watch Marcelo Garcia. He actually flew me and a few of his employees out to New Jersey one year in 2007 to go watch Abu Dhabi. I instantly fell in love. I'm like, I have to eventually do this. Like, this is my goal. At blue belt, I made that goal, and I didn't get in until 10 years later. You know what I mean? So, it was a 10-year goal. The UFC was on, to be completely honest, the UFC was never even on my radar. Like when I first started, I didn't care. Like I saw my buddy get on the Ultimate Fighter. I thought it was cool. He was signing autographs. He was fighting. He was making some money, this and that. And I was like, I'm 23, 24. I'd love to do that. It would be cool to be famous and, you know, as much famous as a UFC fighter gets. You know, they're not crazy famous, but it was cool for a kid. And I just kept taking it step by step, and I won a fight. I won another one. I'm like, let's just see how this goes. Where my guys like Billy and Matt, they want to be the champion. They have way bigger aspirations in MMA than I ever had. So I use that as like, okay, I want to open a gym. I want to make it to Abu Dhabi. Those are my two big things. UFC could help me do that. It gives me credibility. It gives me, you know, experience. I could help train fighters. I could do things like that. So, but Abu Dhabi for me was the sweetest one, even more than UFC, because I failed twice. And then on the third time, I got it. I went to the Abu Dhabi trials. I went to the lower weight class first, 169. I cut all the way to 169, same day. And I lost on points. And then I was like, you know what? Let me go to the higher weight class. I got to 188, but the class was 193. I lost on points. I'm like, damn it. And then I was like, you know what? I'm going to take 2 years. 2 years later is the next one. I'm going to take 2 years. I'm going to lift weights. I have a whole documentary on this, by the way. My process from going from like, I lost to I'm going to win this. And it's on YouTube. It's called Matt Arroyo, Road to Abu Dhabi. It's a cool watch. It's 20 minutes long. And I showed everything I did, the dieting I did, the eating, the protein, the lifting weights, the training sessions, the just getting better and training with different camps and going to Cyborgs and going to here and going to Wagner's and going to here and there, and just freaking really putting truly 100% into it. Like I thought I was putting 100% before, but I wasn't. This was 100%. And when I got there, I had no doubt that I was going to win that tournament. And I did. So that one for me was the sweetest of all physical combat goals that I've ever done. And it gave me a lot of confidence to do other things in my life as well.
That's all we have time for, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much, Matt, for your time. Is there any final remarks, maybe some words of wisdom that you can give the fans at home as we wrap up the podcast today?
Just keep training, keep doing your thing. You know, I want to thank, you know, everybody that's helped me, Rob Khan. I want to thank God. I want to thank Jesus. And for those who know me, I'm a Christian, and I always you know, I'm nothing without God, without Jesus. And I just want to, if you want to follow me, you can follow me on Instagram. My handle is Matt Arroyo MMA. I'm on TikTok, YouTube, all the same handle, Facebook. If you want to learn more from me, you can go to mattarroyo.com, MATTARROYO. I have an online academy. I have a course on every subject in jiu-jitsu, mount, back, side, pass, everything you could think of, how to beat bigger opponents. You could get that all at mattarroyo.com. And if you have any questions for me, I answer literally every question. I look at every message in every folder on Instagram. If you have any questions, or if you just want to chat, or if you just want to, you know, whatever, I'm there. And, you know, I appreciate everybody who follows me. I've grown my following a lot this year, this past year. And I appreciate everybody who follows my stuff.
Follow Matt on Instagram, link in the description, and follow Anything Combat on Spotify. We will see you guys next time. Bye-bye.
Boom. See you guys. Bye.